some of the historical background of the story of Purim. Again, just to reiterate some of the points, remember that the story of Purim took place in the 70 years between the destruction of the first Beis HaMikdash and the building of the second Beis HaMikdash. It occurred shortly after the Babylonian Empire was conquered by Persia, and Ahasuerus is the third in line of the Persian kings who ruled. According to rabbinic tradition, Ahasuerus was actually a commoner who solidified his hold on the throne by marrying Nebuchadnezzar's granddaughter. Although it's interesting, Nebuchadnezzar, was the Babylonian line, and they were simply cut off, but nevertheless, there was some respect for them. And because of the Persian succession of the Babylonian Empire, the capital was moved from Babylon, which is in Iraq, around where Baghdad is, to Shushan, which is in Iran. And that's why this story occurs in a place called Shushan HaBira, Shushan the capital. Now, Ahasuerus himself is mentioned in the book of Ezra as the person who stopped the rebuilding of the temple, meaning the temple had already begun to be rebuilt because of the authorization of Cyrus, King Cyrus, and Ahasuerus stopped it. And in the book of Ezra, it is recorded that the reason he stopped it was because there were people who lived in Israel, non-Jews, who wrote an accusation against the Jewish population that they're building the Beis HaMikdash in order to rebel against Persia. So Ahasuerus stopped the Binyan Beis HaMikdash. That is recorded in the book of Ezra. And according to rabbinic tradition, the people who wrote the accusation were none other than the 10 children of Haman, who in the Megillah are later hung. The building of the Beis HaMikdash was not resumed till after Ahasuerus' death. So not only throughout the Purim story, but even after the Purim story, for the remainder of Ahasuerus' reign, the Beis HaMikdash was not rebuilt, and in fact it was not rebuilt until Ahasuerus' successor, whose name was Daryavish, Darius II, and Darius II was actually his Jewish child that he had from Esther. He had a child from Esther, and they say we're not sure if Daryavish regarded himself as Jewish or not. Halachically, he of course was Jewish because his mother was Esther. But Daryavish Hasheni was the one who allowed and reauthorized the completion of the Beis HaMikdash, and that was exactly 70 years from its destruction. Okay, so indeed that was the fulfillment of the prophecy that was given to Yirmiyahu, to Jeremiah, that the Churban Beis HaMikdash would last exactly 70 years. Right, so the story of Purim begins, therefore, at a time when the Jews are in exile, when a small number of Jews have already returned to the land of Israel. A small number, but they have not been allowed to rebuild the Beis HaMikdash. The majority of the Jews are in Chutz La'aretz, are in exile. And Mordechai, who is considered to be one of the great spiritual leaders of the generation, is also in Persia. Why was he not in Israel? Well, according to the way many Mephorshim reconstructed, he actually initially went from, well, in other words, he was in Eretz Israel. Upon the exile of Nebuchadnezzar, he was sent to Babylon. He returned to Eretz Israel with the first wave of Olim, but when the Binyan Beis HaMikdash stopped, he decided to move to Persia in the attempt to use his good offices to try to secure rights for the Jewish people, including building the Beis HaMikdash. So he went from Israel to Babylon, from Babylon back to Israel, and then from Israel the second time to Persia, which is where he is at the time of this story. Now, the truth of the matter is that the book of the Megillah is a unique book. Of course, the word Megillah is not really unique to the Megillah. Megillah just means a scroll. So any book that is in a scroll, as was true for any all of the Sfarim of the ancients, you can call the Torah a Megillah. The reason, though, why we still refer to the Megillah as Esther is because it is the only book other than the Torah that is universally still read in the form of a scroll. Now, in most shuls, for example, the Haftorah portions, which are prophetic portions read on Shabbos, are not read from a scroll, they are read from a chumash. Similarly, when we read Lamentations, Eicha, Tisha B'Av, etc., we read it from a chumash or from a siddur. Now, in some places, including here, including this yeshiva here, the Haftorah is also read from a scroll, and you can call that a Megillah too. But since the only one that is universally read from a scroll by any halachic Jew is the Book of Esther, so we call it Megillah, Megillah's Esther. But the truth of the matter is that they just mean the word scroll. Now the word Megillah, or the Book of Megillah's Esther is unique because the name of God is not mentioned. And there are a lot of reasons for that, as we will discuss. But essentially, the Book of Esther is designed to teach us two things. There are two things going on in this book. One is the miracle of God looking after us, even when we don't expect it, even when we're not aware of it, even when we think we've been rejected by God. In other words, Megillah is the story of a people who were condemned to die, and through a series of events which many could have interpreted as coincidences or just political realities, we were saved. And the story of the Megillah is to remember that history is not an accident, and to remember that God protects and loves and looks after the Jewish people even when they are in exile, even when they're not even aware that God is present, which is why God's name is not mentioned. God is behind the scenes. There are no miracles in the Book of Esther like the splitting of the Red Sea or the 10 plagues. Everything seems to happen normally. Vashti gets killed because in the ancient world, if you didn't do what the husband wanted, that he was a king, he would kill you. Esther gets chosen as queen. Well, somebody has to be chosen as queen. Mordechai happens to overhear, you know, an assassination plot, etc. Haman happens to plot against the Jews without even knowing that Esther is Jewish, etc. All of these things come together. Each thing individually, any individual event is not miraculous. Any individual event could just be chalked up to coincidence. But only when you see the whole picture do you see the hand of God behind the scenes. So the first and foremost lesson of Esther is the notion of seeing God not only in the miraculous, but seeing God even in the normal and everyday. The concept of Esther. In fact, the Ramban points out that we have two words for miracles. We have open and revealed miracles that are called nes nigle, and then we have the hidden miracles that seem to be just life going on as normal that are called nes nistar. Hidden miracles versus revealed miracles. Purim is Nes Nistar, and that is hinted at by the very name of Queen Esther. Although Esther may be a name of Persian origin, but the Shorish of Esther, Samach Tav Resh, is a verb that means concealment. The story of Esther is the story of seeing God even in concealment, seeing God even in the absence of the miraculous. Like we say in our Shemona Esrei, Al Nisecha Shebechol Yom Imanu. We thank God for the miracles that exist in our life every single day. Breathing, walking, talking, whatever we're able to do. That's why we make brachas. We make brachas on have an apple, you make a bracha, right? Bread, eating, lightning, thunder, going to the bathroom. All of these things are treated as miracles for which one must give thanks to the Ribono Shel Olam. Even though it happens every day, generally speaking. But that's what a nes nistar is. And in fact, the Ramban makes the point that the word nes actually means banner or flag. That God does the supernatural just so we'll realize that the everyday is a miracle as well. So that's really perhaps the single most, I guess I should subdivide that into two. In other words, one lesson is God's love for the Jewish people, that God will come and protect us, etc. The second lesson is to see God in the everyday and the ordinary, and not only in the miraculous and supernatural. Lesson number three, though, that's going on here, is the concept of the downfall of evil. Now, of course, we live in a world where, in the short run, all sorts of evildoers prosper. Now, Hitler managed to be quite successful for 4 or 5 years. But this reminds us, just as Hamann was very successful, but it reminds us that ultimately evil will perish, ultimately evil will have its downfall. And in particular, Hamann comes from Amalek. In fact, Hamann is described as Hamann Ho'agogi, Hamann the Agagite. Now, who is Agog? His ancestor was Agog. Agog was the king of Amalek in the time of King Saul. Shaul HaMelech, this is in the book of Shmuel Aleph, was commanded to eradicate the nation of Amalek. Shaul tried to carry it out, but he spared the king. He spared one person, Agog. And because of this, the book of Shmuel records, Shaul was stripped of his malchus. Shaul was stripped of his malchus. Because of that sin, he was not given a second chance. But Shmuel himself, the prophet, killed Agog. But Chazal tell us that in the little bit of hiatus between Shaul not doing it and Shmuel doing it, Agog was able to impregnate a woman who was undetected, and this woman had a child, etc., and the descendant of this child was none other than Haman. And that's why he is called Haman Ho'agogi, because he is descended from the child of Agog, who was conceived only because Shaul failed to carry out the mitzvah of Mechias Amalek, eradication of Amalek. Now, because of this, there's something that's very important to keep in mind here. Haman is the descendant of Agag, the king of Amalek. Mordechai happens to be the descendant of King Saul. Mordechai is from the tribe of Benjamin. So, in effect, the story of Purim has the descendant of Shaul killing or being responsible for the death of the descendant of Agag, which rectifies and is misaking the unfinished business that Shaul failed to do against Agag. In other words, Mordechai and Esther are in effect carrying out the spiritual mission that their ancestor failed to carry out. So in Megillas Esther, therefore, we are not only reading about the miracles of Hashem and the salvation of Bnei Yisrael, but there's something directly relevant, halachically even, in the downfall and destruction of the evil nation of Amalek, which was to be carried out originally through Shaul HaMelech, but it's now carried out by their successor. Of course, I should emphasize that Amalek was not totally eradicated, even in this story, because although Haman was killed, and although his 10 children were killed, but it's very, very clear that his children had children who were not killed, because in fact we read later about descendants of Amalek. And in fact it is recorded in the Gemara that the descendants of Amalek were converted to Judaism, and they were actually teachers of Torah in Bnei Brak. Right, so, Bnei Banav Shel Haman Limdu Torah B'Bnei Brak. Yes, sir. Yeah, this is actually an interesting Gemara. Yeah. Let me just go over that a little bit. This is the content of ourselves, but we might as well introduce the characters here. Mordechai is described as Ish Yehudi Haya B'Shushan Habira. There was a Jewish man in Shushan, the capital. But let's look at the pasuk itself. Look ahead a little bit at Perek Beis. Pasuk Hey, right. This is one of the verses that are read out loud. Right, there are certain verses that we read out loud when they're reading the Megillah. It says, "Ish Yehudi Haya B'Shushan Habira." There was a Jewish man in Shushan, the capital, Ushmo, and his name was Mordechai ben Yair ben Shimi ben Kish Ish Yemini. So it traces him for a few generations. Now Ish Yemini means of the tribe of Binyamin. Now, literally, although I translated Ish Yehudi to mean a Jewish man, but literally, Ish Yehudi means a man from the tribe of Yehuda. So the Gemara asks the following contradiction. Is Mordechai from the tribe of Binyamin, because it says Ish Yemini, or is Mordechai from the tribe of Yehuda, because it says Ish Yehudi? So the Gemara gives a number of answers. One answer the Gemara gives in effect is that Yehudi in this pasuk does not refer to tribal affiliation, but it refers to the way we use the word today, that he was a Jewish man. And the Gemara explains, anyone who renounces Avodah Zarah and commits himself to the worship of God is called a Yehudi. Actually, there's a beautiful verse from the Sfas Emes that asks the question, why should that be so? After all, why do we call Jews Yehudim? Yehuda is only one tribe. Right, so why is every Jew now called Yehudi? So the Sfas Emes is a beautiful word. The Sfas Emes says that Yehuda in the Chumash was Leah's fourth child. And when Leah had her fourth child, she called the child Yehuda. Why did she call the child Yehuda? Do you remember what the Chumash says? The Chumash says, because Leah said when she had her fourth child, Hapam Odeh Hashem. Now I am grateful to God. Hoda'ah, gratitude. Why was she grateful only when she had child number four and not when she had the first three? So Rashi explains like this. Rashi explains that Leah knew with Ruach HaKodesh, divine inspiration, that Yaakov was going to have 12 boys. She also knows Yaakov has four wives, Rachel, Leah, and two concubines, Bilhah and Zilpah. So she figures if you divide the 12 boys equally, she's entitled to three. So when she gets what she's entitled to, she doesn't feel gratitude, right? Es kum to mir, as we say in Yiddish. It's coming to me. But when she has a fourth one, and she realizes that God has given her more than what she is entitled, that engenders within a human being gratitude. That's what Rashi says. So look what the Sfas Emes says. The Sfas Emes says, every Jew is called a Yehudi because every Jew must go through life with the feeling that God has given me more than I'm entitled to. But you don't go through life with the feeling that whatever God gives you, you know, isn't enough, or I deserve it, or, you know, whatever the good things happen to me, you're coming to me, you know. Like the Ramban points out, everybody always raises the question, why do bad things happen to me, right? Because, you know, because we feel that it shouldn't happen to us. But when good things happen to us, we often don't raise any particular theological question that, Seder, you know, that's the way it should be. So the Sfas Emes says, every Jew must feel, Natalti Yeser Al Chelki. I have taken more than I'm entitled. So that, again, I'm going to get back to your question in a moment. So that's the first answer. In other words, Yehudi means Jew. And like the Sfas Emes, all Jews are called Yehudim. But there's a second answer the Gemara gives, which ties into what you saw in the art scroll. And that is, Mordechai is a genealogical descendant of Binyamin. That's very true. But he owes his existence to the tribe of Yehuda as well. Why is this? Because you see that Mordechai is descended, right, what does it say? Mordechai ben Yair ben Shimi. Now, keep in mind that this is not to be understood as a straight lineal thing. In other words, this skips a lot of generations. This is like, it's as if we would, you know, let's say we would say we would want to trace your Yichas all the way back to hundreds of years. We might, you know, mention five names every 20 generations. So these are actually, this is not a consecutive list. This is, you know, Shimi was not Mordechai's father. It was Mordechai's great-great-grandfather. Kish goes back, etc. But be it as it may, the Gemara says that the reference to Shimi refers to a character in the book of Shmuel whose name is Shimi ben Gera. A man, Shimi ben Gera. What is the story of Shimi ben Gera? The story of Shimi ben Gera is the following. Shimi ben Gera was of the tribe of Binyamin. And keep in mind that a lot of Binyamin people didn't like David HaMelech too much, because after all, Shaul was from Binyamin, And when David took the Malucha over from Shaul, albeit because of the commandment of God, a lot of the Binyaminites felt that David was taking something that rightfully belonged to them. So, towards the end of David's reign, when his own son Avshalom, remember, you know the story of Absalom, his own son Avshalom rebelled against David and took over, and David was forced to run away from his own palace and from his own son, because Avshalom threatened to kill him. So David was humiliated, David was disgraced. And as he's running away, this Shimi ben Gera throws, now David is powerless and without any influence, Shimi ben Gera sees in this a divine punishment for David for taking away the Malucha from Saul. Now, in a way, Shimi ben Gera's thinking is a little illogical, because if the revolt would have been by Binyaminites who would have overthrown David, you know, that would have been the argument. But after all, Binyamin is not getting the throne. The throne was taken over in this rebellion by David's own son, who was also from Yehuda. But nevertheless, Shimi ben Gera sees this as divine punishment, and he throws rocks at David, and he mocks him, and he curses him. And Yoav ben Tzruya, David's indefatigable general, was also David's nephew, said, "Let me just finish him off. Let me kill him right now." And David said, "No. If it's God's will that I should bear this humiliation, then I accept it." Although it's interesting, he did tell Shlomo on his deathbed to finish him off. But be it as it may, Shimi was spared at that particular moment. According to Chazal, Shimi then had another child, and that child was the ancestor of Mordechai. So, meaning the following. If David would have killed Shimi ben Gera, which he was allowed to do because Shimi ben Gera was a rebeller against the king. Someone who rebels against the king is Chai of Misa. So if which tribe is David from? David is from the tribe of Yehuda. If David would have killed Shimi ben Gera, there would not have been a person called Mordechai. Therefore, the Gemara concludes, Mordechai is from the tribe of Binyamin, but he owes his life, his existence, to the action or inaction of David from Yehuda, who did not kill Shimi ben Gera. Does that clarify yet? Which philosophical point do I? Yes. Well, at least when it's Amalek, it doesn't mean you kill it. Yeah. That's right. That's right. That's right.
But I don't understand how this person was handing out some sort of divine punishment which he saw fit, but nothing kind of just stood there at
nothing. Well, again, I mean, Shimon ben Gera was not a Amalek, he was a Jew, and in fact, according to Chazal, he was also a Talmud Chacham, etc. What he did was wrong. It was not necessarily something for which he should die. And again, he wasn't killing anybody. And indeed, we do find, however, that later he did die from it. But what's interesting is the Gemara says the following. You know, the Gemara says that the Jewish people didn't like Mordechai during the whole Purim story. They were angry at him, because they figured Mordechai got them all into trouble because of his stubbornness and not bowing down to Haman. That's why we're all in this trouble. So the Gemara says the following. The Binyaminites were looking at the people from Yehuda and saying, "It's your fault that this Mordechai is here. Because if it wouldn't have been for your ancestor who spared Shimi ben Gera, there wouldn't have been a Mordechai." So the Binyaminites called Mordechai Ish Yehudi. He's from the tribe of Yehuda. The people from the tribe of Yehuda looked at the Binyaminites and said, "He's one of yours, don't blame us." So actually, instead of each one claiming credit, so to speak, each one was passing Mordechai off on the other one. So Mordechai was not very popular. In fact, in a way, you know, it's a funny thing. Mordechai got hit by traffic in both ways. During the incident, until Haman's decree was annulled, Mordechai was hated by the average Jew. The average Jew thought Mordechai was a fanatic. He should have bowed down. He didn't. The argument is, Mordechai sits in a big public place right near the king's palace, and he refuses to bow down to Haman. Well, the argument is, if you want to be religious, so stay at home. Meaning to say, you have to make a point of sitting in a public place and not bowing down. So the truth of the matter is that many of the Jewish people who were assimilated anyway, they thought Mordechai was a fanatic and he was endangering their lives. Now, you think after the end of the Purim story, where Haman gets killed, etc., Mordechai should now be a great hero. So here the Gemara says that Mordechai was held in great esteem by the average Jews, but the Sanhedrin, the Talmidei Chachamim, kind of distanced themselves from Mordechai after this story because he was so involved in communal welfare and politics that he was no longer intensively studying Torah. So in a way, when he was, you know, righteous and very, very firm, the common folk distanced themselves from him. And when he saved the common folk, the Talmidei Chachamim distanced themselves from him a little bit, because they figured that's why it says at the end of the Megillah, it says at the very end of the Megillah, Ratzoi l'rov echav, he was beloved by most of his brethren. How does the English translate? I think the English may translate a little differently. Look at the chapter 10 at the very end. You see, it's interesting how the English masks over some of these subtleties. The English says Mordechai the Jew, was a great man among the Jews, popular with the multitude of his brethren. So multitude. But the word of rov actually means he was popular with the majority of his brethren. And Rashi makes the point that the Sanhedrin distanced themselves a little bit from him because he was not as intensively involved in Torah as he was prior to this. So the concept is, the Gemara even says, that even if what you're doing is saving lives, and of course the halacha is you stop learning to save a life, but there's always something you're going to be missing. In other words, things have a cost. Just because the Torah says saving a life overrides everything, which of course is true, except, you know, for idol worship and the like, that doesn't mean that you don't suffer a cost. It is a cost. It's a loss of Limud HaTorah, which is a cost God wants you to incur, but it's still going to be something that you're missing. Which means, therefore, if it, anything short of Pikuach Nefesh, we should be very careful not to try to miss those moments. Now let me speak a little bit, though. So these are kind of the three things in this story. I mean, there are many more, but three basic things. One is the concept of God's love and care for the Jewish people. Two is the hidden nature of the story of Purim, to see God in the ordinary and coincidental, and not only the miraculous and the supernatural. Now that's a lesson not just in Jewish history, that's a lesson in my individual history as well. I, as an individual, need to have a sense of God's presence in my life, even when nothing amazing is happening. Or to be more accurate, the things that always happen are amazing. I just get that sense of wonder in the world. And the third is the downfall of evil and the eradication of Amalek. And the fact that this is a story that shows that this does happen. Now, of course, in everyday life is not always as neat a package as the Megillah. But it takes time, and sometimes it's not even in our lifetimes. But we very much believe that evil ultimately does not have any type of permanent prosperity, not only in the world to come, but even in this world there will eventually be the downfall of evil, although not always in the lifetime of a single person. So those are the three basic ideas here. Let me talk a little bit about Amalek, just to get a sense of the precursor of the history here. People ask a kasha. This is a well-known kasha all the Rishonim ask. When Yaakov is on his deathbed at the end of the book of Bereishis, Yaakov blesses the tribe of Judah, or the person Yehuda, and says, Lo Yasur Shevet mi Yehuda. The scepter of authority shall never depart from Yehuda. Malchus, kingship over the Jews, is given to the tribe of Yehuda. In fact, the Ramban even makes the point that that's why the Chashmonoim of Hanukkah fame were Kohanim. That's why, although they were righteous people initially, they were totally wiped out and destroyed, because it was improper after waging battle for Kohanim to usurp royal prerogatives, because Malchus was given to the tribe of Yehuda. So, now, of course, you could ask a question about this. So how do we understand the 10 tribes, which for hundreds of years had a separate kingdom, a malchus. So the Ramban makes the surprising assertion that although the initial breakaway was divinely authorized, God basically told Yeravam to become king over 10 tribes, it was against halacha for that to continue. It should have been, the Ramban asserts, that Malchus Yisrael should have been disbanded after the death of the first of those kings. See, the first king was told by a prophet to secede, but they should have rejoined the union. Now that's a tremendous chiddush, to tell you the truth, because Malchus Yisrael is a very corrupt society, and all of their averos are detailed over and over and over again, avodah zarah, everything else. But as far as I know, there is no condemnation in Tanakh of the mere fact that they remained a separate Malchus. See, the Ramban is saying the very existence of that separate kingdom was a sin. By the way, an interesting halachic classification. That is that one of the 613 mitzvahs in the Torah that Malchus belongs to Yehuda? No, it's not, because it's not a mitzvah. A mitzvah is what God says. Lo yasser shevet mi Yehuda is not the words of God, it's the words of Yaakov. Right? The words that a human being utter, the human being tells his sons, my will is that this one should be the king. Even if that is recorded in the Torah, that is still Yaakov's will. It is not automatically considered a mitzvah. But it's a little confusing, because the way the Ramban seems to describe it, it's not a mitzvah, but the fact that it is Yaakov's will means it's also the will of God, because Yaakov was a tzaddik. Yaakov, of course, was a tzaddik, and therefore it is God's will that you carry out what your father said. It's like honoring a parent, but it's not a mitzvah per se, but it's like an expression of kibud aviyeh. Now, here's the question all the Rishonim ask. If Yaakov Avinu declared in his bracha that monarchy belongs to the tribe of Yehuda, then how do we explain the fact that the very first king that the Jewish people had was not from Shevet Judah, as David HaMelech is, but it was King Saul, Shaul HaMelech. And Shaul HaMelech is not from the tribe of Yehuda. Shaul HaMelech is from the tribe of Binyamin. Now, and you can't say they there was an Aveira there, because God himself said, choose King Saul. So how do you understand Shaul HaMelech in light of Yaakov Avinu's directive of Lo Yasur Shevet Mi Yehuda? And this is a question that the Rishonim ask, and there are a lot of different answers that are given. One answer that would appeal to a political scientist is this. If you remember your American history, when Lincoln was elected to his second term in the middle of the Civil War, so his vice presidential candidate, who was vice president, was Andrew Johnson. Now, Andrew Johnson was a senator from Tennessee, and Tennessee was a state that had actually seceded and gone to the Confederacy, but Andrew Johnson remained loyal to the Union. What was Lincoln's cheshbon, as it were? Of course, Andrew Johnson, of course, was the last president before Clinton to be up for impeachment and everything else. Why did Lincoln want somebody from the Confederacy, essentially? Because Lincoln knew, very smart man, Lincoln knew that the Confederacy would have a very, very... He knew the Union would win, and he also knew that the Union would not accept the Confederacy very easily. They would try to abuse them, humiliate them, denigrate them, take away their rights, punish them. And Lincoln wanted to show that they, too, are part of the United States, and he, Bedafka, wanted to be Makarev, someone from a state that had seceded from the Union. And in fact, Andrew Johnson, when he became president, sorry for the extended American history here, but when Andrew Johnson became, which you'll see, that actually fits in very, very well. When Andrew Johnson became president after Lincoln's assassination, Andrew Johnson made great overtures to welcome in the Confederacy, which is the main reason why he was up for impeachment. I mean, they had other things, made up things, but the main reason was the Northerners were extremely angry at this Southern upstart who's treating these rebellious states as if they should have equal rights. Now, let's go back to the Tanakh. Shortly before Shmuel was born, there was a certain incident in Tanakh in which the tribe of Binyamin almost got totally decimated. This is recorded at the end of the book of Judges. And this is the horrendous incident that is called Pelegesh B'Giva. The maidservants, or the concubine in Giva, Giva was a town in Binyamin. Basically, there was a man who was traveling around, and he had a maidservant with him. And when he came to the tribe of Binyamin, Binyaminite territory, he wanted lodging for the night. And essentially, a bunch of hooligans gang raped this Pelegesh, and they left her for dead. Right? And so the man then did a very macabre thing. It's actually very strange to justify what the man did. The man was outraged, in effect, and he demanded justice, and for whatever reason, the Binyaminites were not delivering the offenders. So he cut up this woman's body in 12 pieces, and he mailed, or whatever, he sent a piece to each tribe demanding that justice be done, demanding that this type of lawlessness and violence, there be discipline. Now, was there a halachic heter for this man to do what he did? Apparently, as far as I can see, there's really no halachic heter to mutilate a corpse and send a piece, but this is what he did. Well, the entire Jewish nation declared a civil war against the tribe of Binyamin. Imagine all the tribes, it's really 11 tribes against, because Sheva Levi didn't fight per se, but 11 tribes against one. And the tribe of Binyamin was almost totally decimated. And not only that, but people took an oath that they will not allow any of their daughters to marry into the tribe of Binyamin, to ensure, in other words, that this tribe would die out. There's only a few thousand people left, and they would eventually die out. Well, eventually it was seen that this was not a wise oath, and indeed it was God's will that there be 12 tribes. And in fact, the 15th of Av is considered to be a festive day, and one of the festive events of the 15th of Av is that this vow that was made was annulled on the 15th of Av. But be it as it may, it could very well be that the whole incident of Shaul HaMelech, of the Jewish people asking for a king, was relatively shortly after Pelegesh B'Giva. Relatively after a time when Binyamin was rejected, isolated, and almost massacred. It could be, therefore, this is actually speculation, I've never seen this as a reason, I'm just suggesting it as a possibility, it could very well be that HaKadosh Baruch Hu wanted the first Melech to be from Binyamin, to teach Klal Yisrael and Shevet Binyamin that they are an equal tribe within the rest of Klal Yisrael, to overcome the stigmatization and the rejection of the Maisa of Pelegesh B'Giva. Again, what made me think about this was thinking about the Lincoln and the Reconstruction. It's a very similar idea that you want to bring them back in. Okay, but that's speculation. The Rambam gives another reason. Again, what's the question? Our question is, how do you understand King Saul if Malchus belongs to Yehuda? So the Rambam says the following. The Rambam says the Jewish people ask for a king the wrong way, the wrong purpose. Right, it's very clear. Shmuel was angry at the way they asked for a king. They wanted a king k'chol ha'goyim. They didn't want a king to guide them in the way of the Torah. They wanted a king like all the nations have a king. So they asked for it, and of course, and part of it was they were rebelling against the so-called theocracy of Shmuel, you know, the religious states. So the Rambam says, since they asked for a king with an improper purpose, God deliberately gave them a monarchy that by definition could not endure. Meaning Malchus Shaul could never endure because it's from the tribe of Binyamin. But God didn't want to give them the real thing because they didn't deserve the real thing yet. So God gave them the fake thing. So the Rambam, Maimonides, views Malchus Shaul as a fake because they were not yet deserving of the permanent Malchus because of their attitude in rejecting the religious leadership of Shmuel. Now, I will tell you that there is a kasha on that, because the Torah, not the Torah, the book of Shmuel implies that had Shaul carried out the Amalek job, he would have had the monarchy forever. Meaning, see, according to the Rambam, the pshat would be the monarchy never would have remained with Shaul. It was a one-time thing. But l'chora, isn't that contradicted by the account in the book of Shmuel that seems to say you could have kept it, you Shaul could have kept it had it not been for your sin? So that's a little difficult. Although I think the Ramban perhaps suggests that maybe Shaul's descendants could have been governors, or they could have been prime ministers, meaning to say, it certainly wouldn't have meant they would have been the kings, but perhaps they could have had some political office. Or actually, I was once teaching the book of Shmuel to some women many years ago, around 20 years ago, and one of these students suggested a possible answer. You know, David married one of Shaul's daughters, right? The famous Michal Bat Shaul. And Michal Bat Shaul had no children. But it's interesting that had Michal Bat Shaul had children, the royal line would have been David's line, but it would have been via Shaul through the maternity. So maybe the pshat would be, had Shaul not sinned, the Malchus would have been continued through Shaul's daughter. So that way they could have been. But be it as it may, Shaul as the king, that could not have lasted. Yeah.
We define it through the man,
but still there would have been some connection. Perhaps that would have been a connection as well. I'm sorry, his mother.
Wasn't there something along the lines of you're supposed to kill their cattle also?
Yes, there were two things that were not done correctly. One is he did not kill Agag, and the other is he spared the sheep.
And there was something, I think Hashem said, what is the sheep that I hear from?
Right. That's what Shmuel said, right. I'll talk about that too, but that's a very good point. There are two problems here. But of course, Haman, per se, is only traceable to the survival of Agag. It's an interesting thing, because it does say that the Amalekim, you're raising an interesting question, because the Amalekim had a capacity to change themselves into animals. So who knows? Maybe there was a little bit, maybe Haman is connected to that sheep or that cow too. We really don't...
Maybe this is the hidden mother.
The hidden mother, right. Maybe some type of cloning. Who knows? Yeah. I'll get back to that. So again, how do we understand Malchus Shaul? So one answer is, as I say, it was a reconciliation in the aftermath of Pileg HaShpagiva. A second answer is, they weren't ready for the real thing, so God gave them a fake Malchus. There's a third answer, though. And this third answer is the most relevant to Megillah. You'll see how all of this will connect to Megillah. And that third answer is that before the Davidic monarchy could be established, which is God's true monarchy, the evil of Amalek must be taken out of the world. And the evil of Amalek can only be taken out, this is a Gemara in Bava Basra, the evil of Amalek can be eradicated only by Rachel's children, only by the children of Rachel. Now Rachel had two children, Yosef and Benjamin. It cannot be taken out by the children of Leah. Well, I'll discuss why. But if you accept that Gemara, we understand you need, in order to pave the way for Malchus Beis David, you need a precursor from Rachel who will be able to get rid of Amalek. Now, in fact, what this means is the following. Had Shaul from Binyamin, Rachel, carried out Mechias Amalek completely, David would have been the Mashiach. That would have been the final redemption. As it were, because it was not perfectly carried out, so David became king, but he was not really Mashiach. Now, this pattern, let me first show you the pattern, then we'll try to see why. The pattern is, the confrontation with Amalek needs Rachel over Leah. Let's go back and see where we see this. The very first time Amalek attacks us in the desert, Moshe Rabbeinu appoints soldiers to wage war. Right? Moshe's on the mountain, when he lifts up his arms and people look at him, you know, they think about Hashem and they win. That, who did Moshe put in charge of the army to wage war against? Well, this is Amalek. This is his very first appearance. Right, this is Yahushua's very first appearance in the Torah. Yahushua, or he wasn't called Yahushua then, Hoshea ben Nun. Yahushua he was given later by the time of the spies. What tribe is Hoshea ben Nun from? Ephraim. Ephraim was the son of Yosef. Yosef was the son of Rachel. Amalek required Rachel. Later, King Saul is from Binyamin, also from Rachel. Right? Amalek requires Rachel. And that's why you don't find the command of Amalek repeated in King David's time. In King David's time, there were pockets of Amalekim in the land of Israel. But the kayach to eradicate Amalek was a kayach of Rachel, not a kayach of Leah. Again, I'll try to show you why, but I'm going to show you the pattern. That is why, you may have heard, Lassid Lavo, we talk about the ultimate Mashiach is Mashiach, the son of David, or descendant of David. But there's supposed to be an earlier figure, a very shadowy figure, who's called Mashiach, the son of Yosef, who is going to get killed in war. And what is this role of Mashiach ben Yosef? Well, it would seem, according to this explanation, that Mashiach ben Yosef is designed to complete the eradication of Amalek, to pave the way for the revelation of God, which is the coming of the Mashiach. Because as long as there's Amalek in the world, the Torah describes Amalek as a hand on the throne of God. And the word for throne is kas, or case, not kisei. It's missing a letter. So Rashi says, as long as there's Amalek in the world, the throne of God is not complete. Okay? In fact, it might very well be, Mashiach ben Yosef may not even know that he's Mashiach ben Yosef. In fact, perhaps he was some American GI who died fighting Hitler. In other words, he contributed to eradicating this Amalek in the world. So we do see a pattern. So some Mefarshim learn, therefore, that although ultimate Malchus belongs to Yehuda, you needed the transition of a Binyamin or Ephraim. Sometimes it's from Yosef's side, sometimes it's Binyamin. I don't have an explanation for that. In order to fulfill Mechias Amalek. Mechias Amalek. Now, the Gemara itself makes this point. The Gemara itself makes this point that Amalek can only fall by Rachel's children and not Leah's children. The Gemara doesn't say why. Now, why that is so, there are a number of reasons that are given. One reason is, you know, Amalek is the grandson of Esav. Right? Amalek is the grandson of Esav. And when Yaakov confronts Esav, all of his children bow down to Esav in obedience, except for Yosef, who stood tall to protect his mother, and Binyamin wasn't born yet. Binyamin wasn't born until they got to Israel. So consequently, all of the brothers who acknowledged in a spiritual sense the sovereignty of Esav are subservient to Amalek. But Rachel is not subservient to that Koach. That's one reason that's given. Yeah. I'll discuss that. Amalek, in truth, has two definitions. There's the narrow and the broad. The narrow definition is a genealogical nation, which is probably extinct. There's a broader definition of an ideology, which I'll talk about. Yep.
So, I mean, if you imagine somebody who's not linked to lineage, but has the essence of the ideology, I mean, Jewish people still have to eradicate?
Well, Reb Chaim Soloveitchik used to say that any nation or any person who wishes to destroy the Jewish people is halachically Amalek, whether or not they're descended from that nation or not. Amalek is the power that wants to destroy Jews from the face of the earth. Now, here you have to be very, very careful not to use Amalek, not to use the title Amalek indiscriminately. For example, Hamas, you know, as reprehensible and as evil as they are, you know, if all the Jews would move to Borough Park, get out of this land, they would be perfectly happy. In other words, people who want territory from us, people who want money from us, people who want to kill us because they want to take something away from us, that's not Amalek. Evil, Rishayim, of course, that's not the issue. But it's not Amalek. Amalek is a unique pantheon. Amalek is those who want to destroy us for no reason other than their desire to destroy holiness in the world. So Hamas is not Amalek. Hitler clearly was, at least like Rav Chaim's definition. Because the characteristic of Amalek is they attacked us when we didn't have any land, we didn't have any power. There was no political motive. Hitler, you know, gets together millions and millions of Jews, many of whom live in poverty, many of whom have, you know, no way of doing anything against him. Right? This was a desire to destroy Jews from the face of the earth. Stalin had a different, had somewhat of a different agenda. Stalin was not directly committed to physical genocide, but Stalin very much wanted to destroy Judaism from the face of the earth. In a sense, that was also a form of Amalek. Not to destroy the body, but to destroy the spirit. So Rav Chaim does say that there are modern versions of Amalek based on certain ideologies as well. Now, yeah.
You recognize certain ideologies to eradicate such a person?
That's a very difficult question, because it may be that the technical mitzvah of eradicating Amalek applied only to a specific nation.
Is there any clarity today who would be defined as an Amalek?
No, basically, if you'd ask anyone in Shiloh, nobody would tell you go out. I mean, the Rambam does right. If you know somebody's from Amalek today, you are mechuyev to go ahead and kill him. But the truth is that nobody would ever tell you that, simply because we never know for sure. Now, there are other reasons why if I saw Hitler, I would kill him. I mean, in other words, I don't have to call him Amalek. I could kill him because he's a Rodef. He's someone who, you know, in other words. In fact, it's very interesting. My aunt gives me shivers to think about it. You know, during the war, she was actually hiding out in Berlin. Not hiding out; she was in Berlin, masquerading as a non-Jewish woman. She was just in the middle of Berlin with her son, and she writes that she was at some point she was at a Nazi rally. You know, she said she was like 10 feet from Hitler. She just said she just wished, you know, if she had a gun or something, you know, even though obviously she would have been killed immediately, but she wished at that moment she was able to do it. But imagine, you know, so certainly someone that would have the kalach to kill him or destroy him, that would be a tremendous mitzvah. But that's not necessarily because it's Amalek. It's because he's a rodef. There are many other reasons.
You said before about the fact that they're probably extinct.
Yeah.
I've never heard of any reason to think that, I mean, just because we don't know who they are. I mean, basically, just like any other tribe on the face of the earth, they intermingle,
we don't know
who
about the Moabites, none of them, right? Who are the Moabites, the Ammonites, right? All of those, the ancient Egyptians.
It only takes one guy having a baby somewhere. You know?
Yeah, I understand.
What does the Rambam do with the Torah that says
that itself is a very fascinating problem, because on one hand there's a commandment to kill Amalek. On the other hand, it's not just a question of the Rambam. It's good. On the other hand, we have a Gemara that says that his descendants were great Torah teachers. So apparently that Gemara assumes that you only kill an Amalekite until he converts, but he does have the right to convert. In other words, an interesting thing. According to that Gemara, Amalekim have the right to convert to Judaism and be accepted. That's the simple meaning of the Gemara. Now, that happens to... The Rambam doesn't address that one way or the other. Huh?
Two answers I've heard.
Yeah?
One is, Ein Lachov Nachiyah Gedolim. That's the
okay, all right, very good.
The second is that the Girsa should be Bnei Naaman.
Okay. Yeah, let me just explain that. The suggestion has been made that if the concept is to eradicate Amalek, for an Amalekite to so repudiate the Amalekite in him and become Jewish, that's a true eradication. He's truly destroyed the Amalek within by that type of person, assuming it's sincere. Others are saying that they're not Goris in the Gemara, the word Haman, the Goris Naaman, who was from Ammon, a different nation. Okay, so there are different answers to that. Now, because the truth is, there is a Mechilta that says we don't allow conversions from Amalek, but again, the simple meaning of the Bavli seems to permit conversion. So, on one hand, you kill them, on the other hand, they have the right to convert. So.
Sounds a bit like an Islamic concept where Amalek is all the rest of the world, not Amalek.
Well, yeah, but we don't apply. I mean, we certainly don't define Amalek as anyone who's not not Jewish. So this is the now. Let me just go over briefly some of the reasons why Machias Amalek belongs only to Rachel and not Leah. One is because the Bnei Rachel didn't bow down to Esav. Another reason is this: Esav has one great spiritual merit on his side. Esav was exemplary in the honor that he showed his father. Esav was exemplary in kibud aviyim. Now, whether he did it because it was sincere or he did it to fake out, that's really besides the point. And even if his motives were not pure motives, but lamaisa, he was someone who treated his father with the utmost respect. You know, even though he was a murderer, he says, I'm not going to murder Yaakov till my father dies, because he didn't realize Yitzchak would live for another 60 years. That's right. You know, when Yitzchak gives the blessings to Esav, and you get the impression Yitzchak is about to die, Yitzchak lives like 60 years after that. Yeah. So Esav figures, oh, my father will die, then I'll finish Yaakov off. But Yitzchak kind of lingers on for many, many more years. And by that time, Esav's anger is kind of dissipated, and he doesn't do it anymore. But be it as it may, because Esav has the sechus of kibud aviyim, all of the brothers who very much hurt Yaakov by selling Yosef don't have the power to go against Esav, because Esav has that spiritual zechus over us. The only exceptions are the children of Rachel, because Yosef was the victim. Yosef did not do anything in derogation of his father's honor, and Binyamin was too young to participate in the Mechiras Yosef. And therefore the concept is that only those who don't have the taint of disrespect to their father have the spiritual koach to vanquish Amalek, who has this quality of kibud aviyim. Yeah.
How does that play with the thing where when Pharaoh made the remark about Yaakov Avinu and Yosef didn't, so then we use that as a reason to say why
Yosef died first. Yeah, that's next question. Yeah,
Mashiach and Yosef will have to die.
That might be so. It might also be though that Yosef's lack of respect for Yaakov in allowing Yaakov to be called your servant was a sin of omission. So it was a sin, but it was not as grievous as the brothers selling Yosef.
But it's like a halfway. In other words, when with Mashiach and Yosef,
that's why
he will be doing a great thing, but he'll still end up.
That's right. In other words, he's not zocheh to see the success of his efforts.
Right.
That's a good point. Now, another reason why it's Zera Rachel is because the Achilles heel of Klal Yisrael is sinas chinam, hatred and polarization. And because we hate each other, because brother hates brother, that's why we're victimized by the hatred of brother Esav against us, because Esav is also our brother. Okay? We are at the mercy of the hatred of Esav, our brother, because of the sinas chinam that exists between us. Consequently, it is the children of Rachel who exemplify the notion of selfless love. Yosef was victimized by the sinas chinam of his brother, but Yosef did not hate his brothers. Yosef did bring lashon hara about his brothers to his father, but Yosef's motives were ultimately to help his brothers, not to disparage them. Rachel herself, remember that Yaakov suspected that Lavan would try to switch Rachel and Leah, remember that? And therefore Yaakov made up with Rachel in the dark, special identification signs, and Rachel at the last minute gave those signs to Leah. So Leah, Rachel represents selfless love. In order not to be at the mercy of hatred, you have to be a person that has the midah of selfless love. therefore it is only the children of Rachel that can vanquish Amalek. Amalek represents the hatred of brother against brother. Rachel represents the love of sister for sister, and therefore it can counteract Amalek. Be it as it may, what all of this simply showing is that the purpose of Malchus Shaul was to create the mechanism for the eradication of Amalek that could only be accomplished by Malchus Rachel and not Malchus Leah. And when Shaul didn't do it, it had to await its fulfillment via Mordechai and Esther, who are the descendants of Shaul. Now, one thing, just I'll leave you, what time do you have?
4 or 5, 7.
Okay. Okay, why don't we stop here and we'll continue this tomorrow.
How do we know that they're going to be the descendant of them, specifically, not just Binyamin in general?
Yeah, Chazal identified because the last name in the list of Mordechai's Yichus is Kish. And although it could be a different Kish, but Kish is the father of Shaul. So they trace Mordechai's lineage all the way to Shaul.
Mordechai is the father of Shaul.
Yeah, yes. Yeah. So although Shaul is not mentioned, but we have to assume that
maybe it's Shaul's brother, maybe, or something.
No. Why?
If Kish is the father of Shaul, yeah. That doesn't follow that Mordechai is necessarily.
I understand that, but it's understood that he's also a I have to check.
Unless Shaul had no brothers.
I believe Chazal say that it came through Shaul, but I'll check. Perhaps it might be through a brother.
Like